Welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast with me, Nathan Alexander, and my co-host, Todd Tavares. Moving beyond questions of God's existence, this podcast asks what atheists should be doing next in a godless world.
Everyone, today we're joined by Charles Develin. Charles Develin is a senior lecturer at the University of Kent in Canterbury, United Kingdom. He works in the fields of history of ideas and contemporary political thought, looking at the roots of modern atheism and the contemporary relevance to historical thinkers on issues such as toleration and secularism. He has recently published two books which illustrate this double interest. The first is Positive Atheism, published by the Edinburgh University Press, which builds a theory of positive atheism from the French Enlightenment thinkers. And the second is Gilets Jaunes and the New Social Contract, printed by Bristol University Press, which provides an analysis of the recent Yellow Vest movement in France and its impact on the relationship between state and citizen. He is currently working on a manuscript on the Macron regime, on the ideological roots of French neoliberalism. Charles, welcome.
Well, thank you for your invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for making time. You seem like quite the busy guy.
It's true that with a couple of books out, it's been a busy couple of years.
Yeah, thanks, Charles, for joining us. Maybe just to start, we could talk a bit about your background. So I guess, you're from France, but you're currently in the UK. Maybe you could just say where you're from in France and then how you made it to the UK.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. It's a bit of a complicated answer because even though I'm French, I grew up in Belgium. So I grew up in the wonderful city of Brussels, the home of the European institutions, where my father was working in the institutions. And I was born in Paris, moved to Brussels when I was 3 months old. So you can see it's quite an early start for my international moving around. And I lived in the US for some time when I was young, from 11 to 14. And that's where I learned to speak English. You can't really tell that from my accent, but I used to speak with a bit of an American twang. It's been a while, though. After that, I went back to Belgium, and then I decided to study in English. So I moved to the UK, and then I stayed. I did my undergraduate, master's, PhD in the UK, and I decided to stay, and I was lucky enough to get a job here.
Fantastic. What drew you to the study of ideas and atheism in particular?
I think when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I was really interested in political thought generally. So I went to do a master's in political theory at the London School of Economics. And that was a bit of an eye-opener for me because I realized that actually what I was really interested in was how ideas came about and how they evolved through time. And it was only really after my master's, I was working in London after my studies, that I discovered this wonderful book by Michel Onfray, who's a French philosopher that I was reading quite a bit at the time. I think the English translation is In Defense of Atheism. And in it, I discovered two wonderful thinkers, Jean Méliès and the Baron d'Holbach, who are in my book on positive atheism. And that's where I discovered them. I hadn't heard of them before. They each have, a couple of pages in the book, which is a more general book on atheism. And I was really interested in them and just started digging deeper, basically.
So maybe we can talk about your book, Positive Atheism, first, and then we'll talk about the Gilets Jaunes book.
That sounds good.
So your book focuses on these four main thinkers, Pierre Bayle, Jean Méliès, Baron d'Holbach, and Denis Diderot in the late 17th century and 18th century, so the 1600s and the 1700s in France. So maybe you can say what was the situation like generally in France at the time in terms of religious and political freedom?
It wasn't very good, I think it's fair to say. There are a number of notorious stories. One is one of my favorites. It's in the book. It's the story of Vanini. Vanini was an Italian doctor. He came from Naples, but he decided to study and work in France. And he wrote a number of books, on notably on medicine, but also he was a kind of a free thinker and a bit of a pantheist. And the term wasn't really there at the time, but that's kind of how we define him today. So he believed that God and the universe were the same thing. And that led him to quite a bit of trouble with the authorities. He was arrested in Toulouse, and he was tried and he was executed for the crime of atheism. Even though during his trial, he protested that he couldn't be an atheist because he thought that this piece of straw that he picked up from the ground was God. And so how can you be an atheist if you believe in God? So you can imagine when people like Jean Méliès, who is one of the authors I discuss in the book, started saying that, oh, actually, I am an atheist. You can imagine how that went. So out of the authors that I look at, you know, it's true that there's a bit of a French twang to it, and it's not a coincidence. You know, I mean, I read French, so it was an easy way into the discipline for me and to make a little bit of a niche for me in the UK. But it's not really the story I want to tell. They're not really particularly French. It's just that they happen to live in a time when you know, French language and French culture was quite dominant in Western Europe, and actually some of them aren't even really French themselves. Like Dolbach is German originally; he was naturalized French. Pierre Bayle, who I discuss in the book, although he's French, he had to flee France because of religious persecution, and so you know the story is quite diverse. It's really a kind of the beginning of a story of European thought and later global thought, really, that I'm interested in.
Well, let's start to get into that thought, because this is, I think it's, Onfray describes it as atheology. And that seems to be what you've picked up on, this positive philosophy. Whereas atheism is typically seen as something more of a negative philosophy, right? Like atheists are against something. They deny the existence of something. But here you're asserting a positive philosophy from atheism. What does that mean, and how do you come to this conclusion?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Todd, that you know, in the beginning of history, we always associate atheism with this negative movement. So it's there from the trial of Socrates all the way into the 17th and 18th centuries when I look at in the book. What's happening is that atheism is defined in a negative sense because it's defined by its opponents. Since it was a very difficult position to have, you know, illegal in France and in many other places, though interestingly not in the Netherlands, the idea of atheism is one that is defined by the people who disagree with it. And this is really what I've looked at post PhD, after my thesis, when I looked at the thought of Méliès and Dolbach. So I'd already done a kind of extensive scholarly work on this, but that was really my question for after the thesis: is why does atheism has this negative perspective? Why do we think of atheists as negating things, negating God, negating theology, negating the political power of priests? When in fact, I had seen during my thesis that they had many positive things to contribute. So that was my central question for the book, is what does it mean then to be a positive atheist? And I guess, I mean, if you allow me just a little bit more.
Please.
I think what I was trying to get at is to try to draw what were for me the beginning of this positive atheism. So along three major axes, I think. The first one is a moral one. So how can you be a moral atheist? And I know you've covered this on the podcast. The second one is politically. How can you be an atheist that has political views? And what are those political views? And the third one was philosophically. What does it mean to have a sort of positive theory of atheism on a sort of a broader philosophical spectrum?
Well, maybe we could explore each one of those three threads, maybe in detail. Actually, I wanted to ask sort of on the political question. There's this famous quote. I think it's from Méliès first, and then Diderot. Something is saying, "Men will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest." So I think there's this this link between sort of religious radicalism and political radicalism. So maybe you can say, well, what is the origin of that quote first, and then maybe just talk more about the politics of it.
Yeah, you're right. There's a variation of this quote that is in Méliès' work. Méliès, interestingly, was a Catholic priest. So out of all the people that I look at, he's perhaps the least obvious when you think about, oh, who's an early atheist? Well, it turns out one of them was a Catholic priest. And you know, in his free time, which is quite amazing when you think about it, he was writing memoirs that he then recopied. We have three copies in the French National Library of the text, and they're all handwritten. And in those copies, he basically says the same thing. There are just minor differences due to, you know, just him copying it, you know, late at night after his duties as a priest. And in those books, in those memoirs, he really tries to tell his parishioners, because the books are addressed to them, that you can free yourselves from not only the idea that there is a God, but also from the political abuses that have come around that idea. So they're giving power to the priests and maybe even power to the king. So there's a kind of republicanism that comes from his atheism, because once you've taken away that political legitimacy of the Ancien Régime king, then what you're left with is the possibility for people to make up their own rules and maybe create a new type of republic. And so that is, it is indeed the root in Méliès. Méliès talks about it, and Diderot then popularizes it a little bit later, half a century later, when he talks about it in one of his poems.
Mm. And that sense of political legitimacy, that's something that we can see is very, very direct, right? Because we have this notion of the legitimacy of kings comes from directly from God, right? So if we get rid of God, the king is simply not a legitimate ruler. But from that, that notion in itself doesn't necessarily give us a positive notion of legitimacy or a secular notion of legitimacy. But there are consequences to this sort of secular atheistic thinking at the time that they're writing. We have seen it have an impact. There are consequences to it in human institutions. What are some of the changes that they inspired, these four thinkers?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a difficult and a very good question at the same time. And as you point out, I think there's one thing that needs to be said, is that there is no necessary link between atheism and radical political thought. And I think that's fine to admit and still be interested in how the unnecessary and more particularist ways in which it happened. So you have people like, for example, a bit later than the four thinkers I look at, but the Marquis de Sade, for example, has no interest in political theorizing. He's interested in how not having a god frees his sexual libido, right? But he's not very interested in what this means for justice and the social contract and other notions like that. And the same is kind of true along the four thinkers that I look at in the book, in that they don't share the same political thought. So we have four very different versions of what an atheist might reply to when asked, oh, so what is a positive politics for atheism? And I think, you know, one of the thinkers that has recently talked about this is Jonathan Israel in his trilogy of the Radical Enlightenment. And that did inspire me quite a bit. And, you know, you can quibble over the details, and I know historians of ideas have plenty of issues with Israel's thesis. But I think at the bottom of his thesis, there's something that's quite true, is that there's this notion that we need to radically rethink politics. How we rethink it is open for interpretation, but the need for radical rethink is there. And that is what's radical about these Enlightenment thinkers, is that they force us to rethink political agency and political power.
I think that's one of the things that we've sort of, we're just starting to find out in America, because the atheism has, or people who are irreligious, it's a growing block and it's becoming increasingly dominant. And the question is, well, what does this mean for the politics? And I think the fear on the conservative side of people of the right and traditionalists see it as this radical break that's set to destroy everything. Whereas atheists themselves, or people who have lost faith or never had a faith, haven't necessarily found those positive connections yet. Like, we're not the only thing that we know. And I think the thing that Nathan and I have focused on ourselves is that, like, liberation from religious rule seems to be the only immediate claim that we can make.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. And I think one of the answers that I have in the book is that this notion that atheism radically changes everything and destroys everything, in particular without building anything new, that is what the opponents of atheism have been arguing. This is the view that atheism is negative. And if you change the perspective around and you say, no, actually, even if you look at the history of atheism, you look at some of its very first proponents, we have positive theories of politics and morality and philosophy. And let's have a look at these. And maybe some will be more convincing than others. But at least by engaging with these positive theories, we can see that there is an attempt to rebuild something. So, you know, then it depends on what you take to be the roots of your philosophical system. And for atheists, it tends to be, at least in the 18th century, a bit less with Pierre Bayle, the first author I look at, but certainly true of the other three, it tends to be a kind of materialism. So we have a thought that is concerned with the material well-being of people. And they start asking questions, oh, should the government be concerned about how people live? Should they be helping them out in their quest for material wealth? Should they be helping them out to, I don't know, like have a happy life? And so we see the development of these kind of proto-utilitarian theories in that time. And that is one of the findings, I think, of the book, is that utilitarianism becomes, in a sense, the first model that is opposed to what comes before. And it's the first positive articulation of an atheist politics.
Well, that's interesting. So now that makes me wonder something else about them. Is there a wide divergence between the four thinkers that you examine, or are they all, do they all come to generally the same conclusion?
Now, there is a bit of a divergence. So Pierre Bayle, the first one, who's mostly late 17th century, he's a Huguenot. So there's not even agreement about his religious thoughts. If you look at the scholarship on him, there are still wide debates today in scholarly journals with people saying he was definitely an atheist, and then others saying, no, he was most definitely just still a religious thinker, just a very unorthodox one. And he's a kind of a monarchist, to be honest, in his political thought. The only thing that he's really against is the use of theological justification for war. So when he's writing in the 1680s and 1690s, he's writing from the Netherlands because he had to flee France after the persecutions of Louis XIV. He writes in a context where people are really keen on overthrowing the King of France and to replace him with a Protestant monarch. This had just happened for the throne of England. William, who was the stadtholder of the Netherlands, became King of England. I mean, he had a claim to the throne, but nonetheless, you know, it was replacing a Catholic monarch, James, with a Protestant monarch. And they thought, oh, well, we've been successful in England. Why not do it in France? Why don't we just overthrow Louis XIV and replace him with a Protestant monarch? And that was a huge political controversy in his day. And Bayle is completely unequivocal about his opposition to these kind of theological justifications of conflict. So I think, you know, he's a monarchist in a sense, but it's only because he defends the legitimacy of the ruler. And on the other hand, to take the other most extreme example, Méliès, who was a Catholic priest, was revered as a kind of proto-communist. In 1919 in Moscow, his name was inscribed on an obelisk as one of the forerunners of the revolution. It's still there today, by the way. If you go to Moscow, you can still see his name on the obelisk. And so, you know, you have a monarchist on the one hand and a kind of proto-communist on the other. So two very different political philosophies.
Right, yeah. Going back to Pierre Bayle, my understanding is he's one of the very first to, or maybe the first to argue that atheists are not inherently immoral. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's kind of why I start with him, because it's the beginning of this positive theory of atheism. So irrespective of whether he was an atheist or not, I mean, I argue in the book that we don't have enough evidence to say he was an atheist, but he still has a theory of positive atheism, which is really interesting, because you have maybe a convinced Protestant thinker who is saying, well, wait a minute, let's have a look at whether atheists can be moral persons or not. And he concludes, well, of course they can. Of course they can, because your moral belief is completely independent from your theological belief.
Hmm. So that seems like it's something that can be built on. Was there a sort of interaction between these four? And at what point did further atheist ideas start to grow out of their work? Or has that happened as much?
There was a bit of an interaction, not so much on a personal level for at least the first three. So Bayle didn't really, well, he was the first. He didn't interact with Millier, even though they were alive at the same time. Millier didn't interact with the other two, but Dalbach and Diderot were personal friends. So they knew each other very well. They met for dinner basically twice a week.
Oh, wow.
Over a period of 40 years. So those two have things in common. Diderot read the drafts of Dalbach's works and commented on them, and so these two have a very kind of a very clear personal connection. But yeah, I think it's pretty clear, though it's there is some controversy in the scholarship, but it's pretty clear that they were aware of each other's arguments. Maybe they hadn't read each other directly. So we don't know for 100% sure that Dalbach, for example, had read Millier. He certainly had read Bayle, but we don't know whether he had read Millier. But it's highly unlikely that he didn't. It's just, you know, in the 18th century, they didn't have strict referencing criteria and bibliographies, and they didn't really care about attributing ideas to individual thinkers. They were very happy to just discuss the ideas. And so even though we don't have a direct connection between some of them, there's at least a conceptual connection between them.
Maybe we could transition on to the Charles II book. And I don't know, and Todd, unless you have any other questions.
The problem is I have too many, and I could, yeah. I would be here all day going back and forth about this. But it's fascinating, and I'd love to get into the three different threads there, but I think in terms of time we do need to move on to
we have a lot of questions about the yellow vest movement as well,
of course.
So it's this gilet jaune or yellow vest movement in France. Maybe can you talk about how this movement got started, and also just why yellow vests?
Right. Yes, I think the yellow vest is kind of the emblematic material thing that we can focus on. It's a yellow vest that you have to have under French law in your vehicle. So if you're driving, then you have to have one of those in case you have an accident or a breakdown, or you need to leave your car in the middle of the highway. You need to put on that yellow vest to increase visibility. So it's a safety measure, right? And everyone has one in their car. So in November 2018, when the Gilets Jaunes decided to have protests, they organized themselves on social media, and they turned up on the roundabouts of France for 70 consecutive Saturdays. So they came on a Saturday, and for 70 Saturdays in a row, in winter, in summer, spring, etc., they just came and they protested. Some of them were there every week, obviously not many, but there were hundreds of thousands in the first few weekends who were protesting, down to a few hundreds per area just before COVID stopped them from protesting. And I think the impetus for them was really to protest initially against a tax. So it's been linked, you know, for American listeners, it's been linked to the kind of Tea Party idea of politics, that you don't want to pay unfair taxes, and that there's a sort of protest against this encroaching role of the state. But I think that's a bit to misunderstand the movement, because it was very clear that this tax, actually this additional tax that was, it hadn't even started yet. It was just announced by the government. That it was just the kind of straw that broke the camel's back. That it was one thing too many at a time when the new government under Macron was actually rewriting the rules of politics, and they were basically saying enough is enough, and we're not happy with the direction of things. And so that's kind of where it starts, and they decided, all right, let's go on the roundabout. There are roundabouts everywhere in France. And we go on the roundabouts and we wear that thing that we each have in our car, and we just say enough is
right.
Enough.
The thing that the government makes us buy and keep in our car.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that, I think, like that sort of, as you mentioned, how it gets that connection to the US Tea Party, which I don't think is fair. I mean, it's a problem for our understanding that when you get these comparisons to the Tea Party, that connection leads to like Trumpism, basically. And how we see something where, mm-hmm. if you follow the threads back, it sort of makes sense, right? We're seeing people who are disillusioned with the neoliberal order, right? We have these promises about how a rising tide is going to lift all boats, and yet somehow they're worse off. The discontent with government elites, the appearance of favoring wealthy urban people over rural and working classes, and a complete lack of government responsiveness. But in the U.S., it ultimately becomes this riot and a coup by proxy, essentially, in January, with people who are their heads are filled with conspiracy theories. They've been propagandized by very specific media outlets to believe things that are just absolutely not true. So where does the comparison between sort of the U.S. patriot Q Tea Party Trumpist movement diverge from the Gilets Jaunes or the Yellow Vests? Are they that common in their roots, or are the Gilets Jaunes far right themselves?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that if anything, the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, are they're anti-political. They are people who tend to abstain from voting in traditional political outlets, during elections, or they're not members of political parties. What they share with two of the movements that I analyzed briefly in the book, which is the kind of the rise in the support for Donald Trump in the US and the Brexit votes in the UK, where I live, is that there is a similar demography, right? So the sociology is relatively similar. We are talking about the kind of white working classes. In French they were called the bouffe, which is a kind of pejorative term to refer to this kind of person. You can imagine the equivalent. In the UK we often hear the term gammon. I don't know if it's a term you're familiar with. It's not particularly nice, right?
Is there an American equivalent? Or Canadian equivalent?
Well, I guess the redneck is the closest.
Yeah.
But okay. I don't know if it's not a perfect comparison, but it's definitely a term that you ascribe to someone you don't like and to devalue.
Yeah,
them.
And give it all those typical stereotypes where they're lesser educated, lesser mm-hmm. so lower social standing.
Yeah, sort of uncultured too, maybe.
Yeah, they are the lesser educated. They are the ones that don't necessarily have a university degree. They are the ones who live in the provinces as opposed to the metropolitan cities that have benefited from globalization. They're the peripheral workers. They're the ones who actually some of them have to wear a yellow vest as well for work, because they work outside, so all these things are kind of, they contribute to the imaginary that, these are just the losers, right? you know, they just can't stand to see the winners reap the benefits of globalization, and they're just bitter about it. And so there is this image that is being portrayed of them as the losers, as the people who haven't managed to, you know, benefit from the global rise in wealth. But if you look at it a little bit beneath the surface, you see that this is a very strange way to look at people who are essentially low-paid workers, most of them. Some of them were also part of the kind of lower middle class. So you have small business owners that took part in the protests. That was part of their sociology. And they're people who, yes, tend to live on the periphery. And so they haven't had the same kinds of opportunities than people in the cities. And they're also the ones who are most affected by a tax on fuel, because they rely on their cars. You know, they don't live in a city. There's no public transport. They have to drive their car to take their children to school, to do their grocery shopping, to go to work. And so they're affected by this tax. But you see that the movement clearly, and very early, actually, in the first few weeks, it moves well beyond the tax. The tax becomes just a symbol. And then they formulate, it's kind of a miracle, this list of 42 demands for a movement that has no leader, no president, nothing. They somehow formulate a list of 42 demands. And if you look at them, I have them in the appendix of the book, they are actually quite widespread, you know, and they're not reacting against immigration. They're not calling for, you know, killing the rich and expropriating them. What they want essentially is to be able to live from their work.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. That it sounds like they're non-ideological, like the way you put it. They're not political. They're not following dogmatic principles. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it developed pretty organically, right? It's kind of a spontaneous movement, and it is a movement. It's not an organized party, and they're addressing their material needs first against perceived grievances. That's something, I mean, for Americans, it looks so different from what we've seen here. I think that's the thing that's worth pointing out, because here it's been marked by, well, the rise in white supremacists, anti-immigrants, xenophobia, and gun violence. Whereas this is something much more, I mean, it sounds positive, is one of the big differences.
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. I hope it comes through in the book, but this is not the way it was portrayed in French media, by the way. The French media turned on them very quickly. After the third week of protest, there was violence in Paris, and the media turned on them immediately. And this is actually when I became interested in them in the first place, because I had read about them in the news, but I hadn't thought about it, you know, in terms of, you know, what this means for the notion of the social contract, until the media turned on them. And I thought, what's happening here? And I started digging and I started doing research, and that really got me interested in why particularly the media and the political class generally turned on them and turned on these social movements that, it seemed to me at least, were making relatively benign calls for what they wanted, you know, higher standards of living.
Which is something that neoliberalism had promised them, right? It seems like it's people who go out and do exactly what they're told to do, and they should get, if we have this policy and you work hard, everyone benefits. And then 20 years later, the benefits aren't there. The hard work has been a waste, and you've nothing to show for it. And I think we probably, the riots, I guess they were called riots in Paris when they were spray painting the Arc de Triomphe and rolling down Champs-Élysées. I found that ironic what came afterwards, because it seemed to be like, okay, they're pushing back against all this glitz and glamour. This is, Champs-Élysées is not the most important thing in France. It's not how French people live. French people need the means to live. And then I think it was shortly after that, the mayor of Paris came out and announced the plan to turn the Élysée into a garden by spending about $250 million. Is that correct?
I don't remember this as a response, but yeah, you could be right. I mean, it's not France, but it's one version of France, the Champs-Élysées. I think it's emblematic.
Yes.
So
the iconicness of it is. Yeah.
There's a roundabout, right? So it's the perfect site for the Gilets Jaunes as well, since they were demonstrating on roundabouts, is the Arc de Triomphe, which sits at the end of the Champs-Élysées, is the roundabout. It's actually the first roundabout in France. But it's also a monument to imperialism, because it was started under Napoleon, it was finished later during the Restoration, and is basically a monument made by emperors and kings to celebrate their military victories. So it's not a celebration of the Republic. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. So the yellow vests were portrayed as these kind of anti-Republicans who were imposing their version of violence over society, when in fact, when you look at the symbol of it, it's actually a reaction against a particular type of we called it kind of presidential monarchism, right? That the French president, a bit like the American president, has a lot of power. And the difference with the Trump supporters is that these people were calling for the resignation of the president. Mm. They weren't calling for him to keep power, right? It's a very big difference.
Yeah. But actually in Canada, we've had also some yellow vest protests as well, although they've been fairly straightforwardly just anti-immigrant. That's is my understanding. Maybe we can, Charles, we can ask you how the yellow vest protests, what's their impact on French politics, and maybe talk about I guess there's going to be a French presidential election next year. Maybe you can talk about how the movement has impacted that. And also, I wonder if you could just explain too quickly, like, how French presidential elections work, because I think they're a little bit different than other countries.
All right. That's quite a difficult task, but I'll try. Yeah. So the first question is, what is the impact on French politics? Well, on the French political class, it's not a lot is the answer. There's not a lot of impact. The politicians have not really addressed a lot of the issues that are underlying and that are still being faced by the same kind of people who were demonstrating during the yellow vest. Two things have happened though, since they demonstrated for just over a year, from November 2018 to March 2020. The first one is that a lot of the measures that they were fighting against were actually reversed. So if anything, it shows that political protests can work. So that's the first thing, is that they actually managed to repeal the law on the tax. So the tax on fuel was not passed in the end. And so they basically got what they were going in for at the very beginning, right? They didn't get a lot of the other 42 demands that they made, but at least they got that. They also got some economic concessions. So Macron was forced to pass through 10 billion euros worth of measures in favor of, you know, the lowest paid workers primarily, but also people on very, very small retirement pensions. So, you know, it had an impact in that sense, economically. Politically, I don't think any of the political parties have really taken them seriously and have really learned any of the lessons from them, which is a bit of a shame, because I think there's quite a lot to learn. Now, when it comes to the elections next year, I'm not going to make any predictions, but I think the thing that you can be sure about in French politics is that a year is a very long time, right? And that anything can happen in the next year. So, you know, a year before the previous election, Macron wasn't really even polling. I mean, there are one or two polls out of the hundreds that put him in a fighting chance of winning the election. And yet he won, right? So he was a huge surprise. I mean, you know, it's quite a feat. You have to give it to him. He managed to get elected, even though he was not a member of one of the big political parties.
He invented his own party.
So imagine. Funnily enough, it has his initials. So his political party was also EM, En Marche, and his name is Emmanuel Macron, so EM. But, you know, I don't think that's a coincidence, but I have no formal proof that it was thought of at the time, but the coincidence seems too big. But the French political system is very, very strange because there are two rounds to our presidential elections. So in the first round, almost anyone can become a candidate. And so you have, for the past 40 years, anywhere from between 10 and 20 candidates for the first round of the election. So it's very different from the American political system in particular, which is the closest one because it's also a presidential system. Because in the US, you have primaries, right? And you know that it's going to be basically a Democrat or Republican. I mean, there are independents, of course, but historically, you know, it's been Democrat or Republican. In France, anyone who can end up first or second in the first round of the presidential debate goes through to a second round. And so this is why we had an extreme right candidate, Marine Le Pen, end up in the second round, is because she came second. So she had, I forget the exact numbers, but just over 20% of the vote. But there were basically four candidates that had near 20% of the vote. So it was a very small margin of error. There was even a kind of far left candidate that came very close. I think he had 19% of the vote. And so you're thinking it could have been a kind of second round with a far right and a far left candidate. It could have happened, right? I don't know if it will happen next year. Like, time will tell. But, you know, it's a very strange system in that someone from a relatively minor position that can gather, let's say, about 20% of the electorate behind them can make it and become president of the country.
And Marine Le Pen, she keeps sticking around. I guess the Le Pens, her father as well, were the far right, have always been, or it feels like they've always been a force in French politics. And I think now she might even be leading in the polling. But like you said, it's still a year out. Le Pen also represents sort of the anti-neoliberalism. Is that fair to say? That they, because she supported Brexit and things like that, right? I know it's from abroad, but she is not an internationalist.
No, that's very fair to say. Yeah, you're right. I think the one thing that I would add a little bit of nuance to is that she's not against neoliberalism, right? So she's not an internationalist, it's true, but if you look at the way that her political party has run municipalities, cities in France, because they have a few mayors, it's been very much on the side of austerity politics. So in economic terms, I mean, she doesn't really have a program, right? She has a program on security and immigration. But in economic terms, we don't really know. So all we have to go by is the way that her party has run cities. And that's the only thing we can judge. And it's been actually quite close to neoliberalism, but certainly not an internationalist one. So that I give it to you. That is not part of her agenda. If not closed borders, at least as close to closed as you can get. And a very particular version of French secularism that excludes, you know, primarily Muslims, right? I mean, these are the targets of her party.
Mm. And they're kind of an anti-EU party as well?
Like only marginally, actually. She used to, the last presidential election, she used to have, I think it was before the debate started, she was saying that she wanted France to leave the euro. In that sense, that would be anti-EU. But she did not advocate even then for leaving the European Union. So she would say, we stay in the EU, but we get back the French franc. And so we can have control over fiscal and monetary policy to a larger extent. But actually, now she's dropped that. So now she's even dropped. So I don't know what she proposes on the EU, apart from maybe being a bit of a nuisance to European partners. There's not actually a Frexit. There is not even a leaving the Eurozone, there is nothing really. There is no policy on Europe.
Can I ask too, just about the Gilets Jaunes, if they have a preferred candidate, or is it kind of spread about among a number of people?
I think their preferred candidate is abstention.
Okay, right.
So I think we can safely assume that they will spread themselves through the political spectrum to an extent, but that the majority will not vote or spoil their ballots during the election. That's been their attitudes, and it continues to be their attitude from the polls that I've been reading. You know, some of them have supported Le Pen, it's true, but it's actually not been a very large percentage. So I wouldn't say that, you know, they particularly favor a far right candidate. I think an equal number would be happy with a far left candidate. So it's very difficult to say, you know, where as a group they would go, apart from abstention, which, you know, is pretty sure for the demographic.
Do the left and right parties, I'm pretty sure the yellow vests would be against Macron, but do the left and right alternatives, do they lay claim to the yellow vests? Do they sort of try to pick up the mantle and say, like, we're the ones who are going to solve these problems, we're the ones who are going to address these claims?
I don't think they've managed. I think there were a few attempts. Le Pen did try very briefly to take some credit for the yellow vests, but found out that she wasn't really welcome at their meeting. Similarly, Mélenchon, who's on the far left, tried to do the same thing and had a very similar experience. So I think when they tried, they didn't really manage. I think part of the problem is much larger. It's to do with, you know, who is representing those people, right? The people from the periphery. And the answer is kind of no one. I mean, the Socialist Party in France has abandoned them. There are books written about this, but that there's been a change in demographic, and you can see it in the UK as well. You can see it in the US, that the center-left parties like Labour and the Democrats and the Socialists in France have changed their demographic. They used to cater more to working-class voters, and now they're catering more to middle-class educated voters. And this shift in demographic has meant that these people are kind of left by the sidelines. And so there's, you know, they're up for grabs in many ways, and they can decide elections, but at the same time, no one is representing them. So it's a little bit difficult for them to have a voice.
I wonder if we could talk just a little bit about secularism in France. And you kind of mentioned it earlier with talking about Marine Le Pen. I guess maybe you could just talk about sort of secularism in French government, because it's done differently in France than versus the US.
It's a very different model. I think you're absolutely right, Nathan. I think what you have to remember is that in the US, secularism was meant to protect religion from state interference historically, right? I mean, it's a broad picture that I'm painting here. But in France, it's the other way around. It was meant to protect politics from the encroachment of the church. So these are two very different models of secularism. So that's why a lot of the time people use a French word to refer to the French version. They use laïcité because it's such a different thing. And it's quite alien to especially an American audience to think about it in that term, that the state needs to be defended from the church. But, you know, we've been through, five republics now. So we've had quite a few revolutions and counter-revolutions. So that might explain why, you know, we're a little bit skeptical of the power of the Catholic Church in particular. And the particular version of secularism we have today comes from a 1905 law in France that established secularism under the Third Republic, and precisely was meant to lower the influence of the Catholic Church, in particular in education, where the Catholic Church still controlled most of the schools in France. And as the government was trying to nationalize the curriculum and was trying to educate French citizens on an equal basis, they felt that they couldn't do it without imposing limits on the church's ability to run its own schools. And so they changed the law, and they made it so that Some things were not allowed anymore in public spaces, such as wearing distinctive clothing, right? So if you're a Catholic priest, you dress in a certain way, and they didn't want those people in schools. And so that's where it comes from. But you can see how, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, then this really changes in terms of the attitude towards Islam. And what's kind of interesting, I guess it brings me back to my other book, is that it's I think it's an interesting area for atheists to think about, because naturally I think we're more inclined, or free thinkers or agnostics, we're more inclined towards thinking in secular terms, but I also think we need to think in secular terms that take into account cultural perspectives. And so in a predominantly Catholic country, in the late 19th century, when the government was establishing its power over the church, 99% of the population was Catholic. Now this isn't the case anymore. So we've had a change in demographic, we've had a change in cultural politics, and it really makes you think about the types of things that are allowed and not allowed. And I think particularly what troubles me particularly as an atheist is when religious or irreligious minorities are being picked on, right? Because if you start tolerating that one particular minority is being singled out, then who's to say who the next one is?
Yeah. And for the American perspective on this, I think often comes down to notions of free expression, where we know that in the, I think in France, the law is against, conspicuous religious displays. So a small crucifix is okay, but a big crucifix isn't. And that's kind of anathema to Americans' idea of what's appropriate to legislate, telling people how to dress, what they're going to wear. And in the French case, particularly like in things like, does this affect Sikh headdresses?
Yeah. Yes, it does. It does. So it affects, the law is a little bit vague, but you're right. It's conspicuous signs of religious belonging are forbidden in certain spaces, right? It's not everywhere. So schools, for example, or public administration buildings. But it's a slippery slope because that's where it started. But then you see that a few years later, initially it was a ban on wearing the veil or conspicuous signs. It wasn't specifically against the veil, but in practice, that's where it started. In schools, so these were minors. So that was the justification of the government, is that these are vulnerable girls that we need to protect. And then, a few years later, there's a ban on wearing the burqa on public streets. Now, I don't know about you, but I go to France every year and I've never seen a woman wearing a burqa in France. I've seen them in London, it's true, but I haven't seen them in France. And when you look at the figures, they estimated that fewer than 200 women were wearing the burqa in France. So it seems like a very, very nasty piece of legislation to pass for something that essentially is not a social problem.
And it seems also really vague, the idea of like it has to be kind of extra, that it's conspicuous. So who, do you know who is actually making this judgment? Who's evaluating the difference between what an appropriate cross size is and when a veil is acceptable and when a headscarf is not acceptable?
I think that's meant to be left at the discretion of head teacher, we call them here, or the school principal. So they can make a case that, this is too much. This is not acceptable. There is also a lot of power in France from the local administrators, the prefects, so they can decide for a particular area. So you can see how in neighborhoods where there's more social diversity, for example, they might be stricter. Actually, ironically, saying no, we want everyone to dress in the same way.
In Canada, we have sort of a strange thing because, for much of English-speaking Canada, our secularism is more on the American model, whereas in Quebec, which is the Francophone part, they kind of take the French version of secularism. So they've got a law that's maybe was passed a couple of years ago, which does kind of prohibit any public official from wearing, I suppose it's the same sort of thing, conspicuous religious symbols. But it's caused quite a controversy in Canada because there are these two kind of conflicting notions of secularism going on. But anyway, I mean, it is interesting, like you say, that the original intention of this particular form of secularism was when Catholicism was dominant. And now in the 21st century, when you have minority religions and so on, seems, yeah, maybe it's not quite as applicable, or it's a different kind of solution for a different issue,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. And Charles, on the flip side of that, how much power does the Catholic Church still have in France?
I mean, quite a bit. So the irony is that the law of 1905 actually also gave a lot of power to the Catholic Church. So it took some power away, but it liberalized its finances. So before 1905, the French state regulated the finances of the church, which means that, you know, they were in charge of how much priests got paid, how much they could spend on their buildings, etc., etc. And the law of 1905 also liberalized it. So it was kind of a compromise. It's the bit that, you know, people don't usually know, that there was a compromise made there. And even though the Catholic Church itself was outraged at the time, the Pope broke off relations with the French state, in the end, French Catholics were quite happy with the compromise. They thought, well, you know, at least we get something out of it. And if you look at the, you know, there's the wealth of the Catholic Church in France, it's still pretty high, right? You know, to the point where when it comes to renovating Notre Dame Cathedral that had a fire, you know, it's in the hundreds of millions of euros that we're talking about for one building, right? Like this, and the church could have afforded that on its own, but, you know, it received right. donations to match
which
the amount.
I think was another soft spot for the yellow vests, was that, like, we're asking for, you know, pennies off of diesel fuel, and no one seems to care, no one seems to want to relent on this. But the church in Paris burns down and people rush to donate millions of dollars.
It is, you know, a bit of a sore spot.
Those sort of social priorities. Which I guess brings us back to the social contract before, because I want to hear a little bit about this. I don't think we mentioned this at all. Well, what is the social contract in France? How is that viewed?
Well, so I think it comes back to what we were talking about for the other book, which comes to this notion that if there is no God, then, you know, political power is up for discussion. And I think the social contract is one of those things where that comes out of it. So if you have no God or no guarantee of a God that gives the particular monarch its power, then what you have is you have the ability for us to talk about it, to discuss what we want, and to change the rules of politics. And I think part of the social contract in that. So in the book, I go through some of the kind of big social contract theorists, and I show how, you know, their thought is relevant in the French context of the yellow vest. So I talk about the concepts of violence, liberty, democracy, and economic justice. I mean, we won't have time to cover it all, but, you know, just to give you a bit of a sense, you know, I think the idea is that if we can talk about these things, we can revise them and we can change the rules of the game. And that's what the social contract is for me. In a sense, it's a bit of an atheological concept, because it says that humans can decide, right? We don't have to accept the laws of the market, or we don't have to accept the laws of God. What we can do is discuss things and come to an agreement and carry it through. And I think that's quite important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I have written down in the notes to ask for your predictions for the election, but you already said that you didn't want to do that. So, yeah.
You know, I have a bet with a friend that for a bottle of whiskey that Macron will lose, but I think it's looking increasingly unlikely. So we'll see. But I'm still hopeful. But at some level, I think it's looking good for him. I mean, the polls do suggest that he would win, most of them at least. I think time will tell, and a year is a very long time.
Oh, yeah, I know. These campaigns seem to last forever now. It's going to be a long haul.
Yeah, it didn't used to be the case. It's very new in French politics, you know. A few elections ago, it was, you know, 3-4 months before the election. But we've become Americanized in that sense, in that we have forever political campaigns.
And forever financing. That's another one. Always raising money, always running for office. Charles, this was fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in. It's really fantastic to sort of to be able to make these connections. And these are the things that we've been thinking about. It's like, as atheists, what are our politics? What are our values? How do we even conceptualize these things? And this, I think, goes a long way to seeing how we can choose the things that we want and how we can implement them, and that there are a variety of ways to do it, like we were talking about with secularism. This is really fantastic stuff.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation and for allowing me to talk about those very, very different sides of my work. But I think that talk to each other, and it was fantastic to be able to discuss it.
It was another fascinating conversation with someone who's doing amazing work with the study of atheism.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. What big takeaways did you get from Charles Develin?
I mean, I think both segments were sort of fascinating. I mean, about the 18th century context and thinkers, and also the current stuff was interesting. I really didn't know that much about the Yellow Vests, aside from just some of the basics, and like I knew that was happening and so on. But I didn't realize what they were protesting about. And then also, I thought I would have guessed that there was some kind of political or more defined like political program behind them. I mean, He did mention that there were these demands, but just the fact that, like he said, like the most likely thing they'll do in the election is abstain on their vote.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was quite right. That was quite interesting.
Right, yeah. that they're not programmatic, right, and that they're able to make demands from their position without being ideological or partisan.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And one of the things, like thinking back on it, you know, taking some time to think about it, it's really impressive that you can start a conversation talking about philosophers from 200 or 300 years ago, talking about atheism and the political implications of it, and transition directly into contemporary affairs, what's happening right now, and everything makes sense. Right, there, you don't have to put everything in a prism of religion.
Yeah.
Right, because the world is atheist, and this is something that we know, and it's how do we engage in it? There is no God; it doesn't matter. Once you get rid of that, you can start to make sense of the world and act in it as a sensible individual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, the other thing is, Charles is just an incredible guy. Great to talk to.
Yeah.
Incredibly knowledgeable. Yeah. And that as soon as he finishes writing one book, he just writes another. And when that book's done, he just writes another. As easy as that.
Yeah. I think it's even more like impressive too, just because the books are on such like widely different topics. So I think that's impressive too.
Yeah. But he says, I mean, this is the thing, we've got to get into them and why we would need to spend a lot more time. There is connective tissue between them, building on the ideas of the social contract, which we weren't able to get into. But just having an overview of these ideas is really impressive and great to know, especially since we, as atheists and as the coming atheist majority, we're going to need to think about what that means for the secular world. What sort of secularism do we want? What sort of secularism will we tolerate? What's the role of the state? What's the role of the church in our society?
Right. I guess we just need to encourage people to buy Charles's two books.
Check it out. Read up on it. What do we have links for down below? We've definitely got links for Charles's stuff.
Yeah.
What else do we have below?
My Twitter.
Twitter.
Your Medium page.
Oh, yep.
And maybe that's it.
That's it. That's all we need.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook if you want to talk to me. Please address all complaints to nath.g.alexander at Twitter. And what else? Subscribe, ring the bell.
Yeah, subscribe.
Pull the string, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and send us money. If you're enjoying the show, send us a few bucks. Yeah, you won't be disappointed.
On the Anchor site, anchor.fm/beyond-atheism, there's a button where you can click to support the podcast, and you can support it for as little as $1 a month. And if you're enjoying the podcast and finding it valuable, we definitely appreciate it.
Definitely. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.